This week on Triangulation, I'm going to interview somebody who's making a difference in the world, creating projects that are helping with internet trolling, censorship of the free press, election security, and a lot more. Dan Kiserling of Google's Jigsaw coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 403, recorded Friday, June 21st, 2019. Google's Jigsaw. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology, a show I share with my co-host Jason Howell and Megan Maroney and Denise Howell. But I'm doing this one. Dan Kiserling is our guest this week. He is the COO of a Google company, an Alphabet company called Jigsaw. Safer from attacks on free speech, safer from online harassment. How can technology make people in the world safer? Welcome, Dan, to Triangulation. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
You came from a mixed background of journalism and politics, which is a good background for something like this.
Yeah, I sort of had a unusual journey to the tech industry, but I've been working at Google and Alphabet Jigsaw now for close to 10 years.
Wow. Did you come on at the very beginning? It seems like that's not much older than Jigsaw itself.
Yeah, that's right. So I was one of the first employees of Jigsaw's predecessor, which was called Google Ideas, when we were still part of Google.
Got it. And what was the idea behind Google Ideas?
The idea behind Google Ideas was essentially to look at some of the biggest security challenges in the world through the lens of technology. And at the time, before our team had proper engineering resources, before we became a technology organization, we were really just trying to understand these threats and think about how technology played a role in them and how that affected the company's decision making. But the story of Google Ideas and eventually becoming Jigsaw is really that our team building the capability to build technology tools and to address the threats that we're forecasting.
Some might say, I told you I wouldn't ask any pointed questions, but let's ask a pointed question. You said it was okay.
Fire away.
Some might say this is just a PR arm of Google to reassure everybody Google cares. Defend yourself, Dan.
All right.
I mean, honestly, a company like Google, they create something like this. You know, the term is used as a think tank, right? But do you actually, I guess the best defense would be, here's what we're actually doing as opposed to what we're talking about.
Sure. So I'll take that in reverse order. I think the reason why Google and Alphabet invests in our kinds of work is it's important for the company to understand how these kinds of threats are going to evolve over a longer term horizon. And that's things like terrorism, censorship, online harassment, cyber attacks, attacks on journalism around the world. These questions are critical to open societies, but they're also really important to technology companies who are thinking about how to increase access to information all around the world. So our job at Jigsaw is to forecast these threats years ahead of time and really understand where they're going, the trends, how to affect them, and then to build technology tools that address those threats. So we're much more even than a research organization. Research is a key part of what we do, but that research is really meant to inform our product development. And we have a number of tools that directly confront the issues that we study.
Oh, good. Well, I'll get to the tools in a second because I want to go through them and find out more about them. I think it's really fascinating, though, that Google foresaw this 10 years ago. I think it's only within the last couple of years, particularly since the 2016 election, that people have started to wake up to the potential threat that social media, a global internet, and 24-hour news can pose to a republic. But it sounds like Google's been aware of that potential threat for some time.
Well, I think if you go back to Google's mission statement, which is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful, the part that I think Jigsaw really focuses on is that universally accessible part. Because as promising as the growth of technology is, there are actors all over the world who are actively trying to constrain people's access to information. And that's either through things like censorship or making it harder for people to report the news, or in some cases using technology as a tool of oppression. And it's really our job to think about how to make that universally accessible part true. And in cases when technology is being used as a tool of oppression, to protect people and important institutions and to make it harder for the oppressors to do what they're trying to do.
All of this sounds fantastic. It also sounds like the Augean stables. It sounds like an endless chore. Do you feel, are we making progress or are we going backwards?
I think the story is mixed. On the one hand, I think we're seeing a real increase in a public conversation around these issues, which I think is really important. I know when we started working on, for example, protecting news organizations from certain kinds of cyber attacks, when you went to talk about this, you really had to explain even what a cyber attack was,
right,
and how it worked. And now, and the same was true when you went to go talk to political parties or political candidates about how to keep their campaigns and how to keep their accounts safer and what kind of threats were out there. The general shared knowledge, you know, many, many years ago was not very high. And now when you go and you talk to these kinds of organizations, most of the time they're fluent in these issues because they've had to live them. And these things are as critical as ever. And 2016, the presidential election and all of the sort of incidents that have followed, I think have just clarified that these issues are taking on a new sense of urgency and sort of a public conversation. So that's encouraging, that we're having public conversations about this and that we're sort of broadening the circle of people who can participate in these issues. As technology proliferates around the world, though, we're constantly having to confront new threats and evolving threats. So our work is by no means done, but we're just getting started.
Yeah. So the cool thing about Jigsaw is it's not just thinking and writing about this stuff. You're actually creating tools.
That's right.
Yeah. Tell me about some of the tools that I know you're working on new ones, and then some have graduated and are out there in the real world. When they're done, do you kind of release them to some other entity, or do you continue to manage them? How does that work?
It varies. So Jigsaw is an interdisciplinary team. So just behind this wall, there are a group of software engineers working alongside product managers, designers, former diplomats, consultants, researchers, experts in a wide variety of issues. Many of the tools that we build sort of are designed to directly confront the issues that we study. So for example, we've observed that a certain type of cyber attack, a DDoS attack, a denial of service attack, was increasingly being used as a tool for censorship. So the way that that kind of cyber attack works is you overwhelm servers with traffic and take them offline.
China just did that to Telegram.
So you see this all over the world.
Yeah.
And it's a fairly inexpensive and easy type of attack to launch. It's often easy to deny where the origin of the attack was. And so what we saw is that all over the world, small and medium-sized publishers were being taken offline.
Oh,
and in many cases, they didn't even know they were under cyber attack.
Wow. They just think, hey, the server's down.
Yeah, they think they're having technical issues. Yeah. And these publishers, critically, are, first of all, usually not rich enough to pay for really expensive commercial protection services. And second of all, they're often on the front lines in conflict areas or in places where, journalism is scarce. These are often some of the most critical outlets to preserve if you want to understand what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. And so we created a service called Project Shield, that protects news organizations, political organizations, human rights groups, all around the world for free from this particular kind of cyber attack.
Yeah, we've talked about Project Shield. It's a really remarkable thing. It's kind of similar to what Cloudflare's doing, isn't it, or no?
Yeah, exactly. We're really encouraged by the fact that the market has responded to this need, and you see other vendors starting to provide similar free services for institutions that are really important for democratic societies.
Yeah.
Journalism, political organizations, that kind of a thing.
So if a site's being DDoSed, they can route their traffic through Project Shield. You have such big pipes that the DDoS usually is thwarted.
Yeah, we have a lot of experience dealing with this sort of thing, and we have, I would say, an unmatched technical capability to defend ourselves against these kinds of attacks, and so we offer that that same level of protection to these kinds of institutions.
I think that's really...
And that's just one of them.
Yeah, oh, I understand. I think that's really an important thing to remember, is that companies like Telegram Messenger probably have the resources when China tries to block them. Telegram was being used in Hong Kong to facilitate the protests last week, and suddenly they got DDoSed. But it's the little local newspaper, it's the little local source of information that doesn't have those resources. I think that's something we tend to forget. It sounds like that's one of the things you really try to do with Jigsaw, is think more globally, think beyond the borders of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is, if you're designing good technology, you really shouldn't be thinking locally, or you shouldn't be thinking in terms of specific countries or geographies. Most of the issues that we confront exist in some way all over the world. And in our case, you know, we try to adopt a global perspective, not only because it's the right thing, but we end up building better technology that way. And studying the circumstances in a lot of different environments, I think, makes for better products.
You're very fortunate. You're in at least the last time I checked, in the Google building in New York City, just above Chelsea Market. The building Google just bought, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, nice. And I see that your offices are appropriately decorated with Jigsaw puzzle pieces.
Yep, very on brand. We're very fortunate to have a very comfortable place to work.
That's
here in
nice.
Lower Manhattan.
That's really nice. How many people are working in Jigsaw?
I think it's around 60 people now.
Okay. And you said it's a mix of engineers and others.
Yeah, exactly. We're a little unique in that way, that we combine sort of traditional technical teams, engineers, product managers, designers, user experience designers and researchers, with people that you might encounter at an NGO or a think tank, or having served in government, experts in certain policy areas, along with people who are experts in partnerships and business development, with all the things that you would expect in a business, marketing and operations and all of that kind of stuff.
Wow.
We all work together here in New York. And so I think that interdisciplinary nature of our team really helps us think about these problems from multiple angles. So not just the technology, but what do we need to understand about how these threats are evolving? What do we need to understand about how to share this information with the public and decision makers, so that they can make better educated decisions about as these issues, you know, are confronted by governments.
That's one of the big criticisms people have of the Silicon Valley culture, is it's kind of monolithic. And so it's very difficult, I think, historically it's been difficult for Silicon Valley to solve some of these problems, because they're all kind of the same type of person. Tell me about the diversity at Jigsaw. I presume that's one of the things Jigsaw is designed to avoid.
Well, I think we really value being in New York, both because it has
sort of
an internet
link
to it. It's cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
It's a really fun place to live.
Yeah.
But also, we're exposed to a lot of different industries, and that's really important. So if we're trying to protect, for example, you know, the press all over the world, it's really useful to be able to interact with big media companies and understand the challenges that they're facing and the threats that they're facing and that their reporters face when they go out to report the news. We're lucky to have access to the international NGO community here. So we have sort of direct access to a lot of on the ground expertise that really helps to inform our work.
That's nice. Yeah. How does an idea become a reality at Jigsaw? What's the process of incubating an idea?
That's a hard question to answer.
There's no
one way. Yeah, the cliche is true. In some cases, our projects are the result of really careful long-term planning, strategic thinking, sort of designing an approach to a situation. In other cases, opportunities come up. Someone, for example, from Kenya will call us and say, hey, our elections website keeps going offline every time we host an election. Is there something you all can do about that?
So people come to you sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. And a big part of our methodology also is going into the field and of sending people to really understand how people are confronting these problems firsthand. But I should say, some of our projects come around because an engineer has a notion and pursues it and builds support for an idea that sort of grows organically. And by the time, before you know it, there's a real interesting technological innovation there. Sometimes our work emerges from partnerships with other organizations. And sometimes we sort of think for a long time and plan a sort of longer term approach to tackling any issue.
There are a lot of new issues, too. One of the issues that we're starting to kind of gnaw into, and we cover a lot on our show this week in Google, is the issue of artificial intelligence and biases in artificial intelligence. You're working on that as well. In fact, you have a
yeah, we are.
Conversation AI that you're working on?
Yeah. So let me tell you a little bit about some of our AI work.
Yeah.
We have a team that is looking into how machine learning can help host better conversations across the internet and help protect targets of harassment, help diminish toxicity online. And what we have is a product called Perspective that makes these machine learning models that detect toxicity available to publishers and platforms all around the world for free. And so, for example, the New York Times uses Perspective to help it moderate its comment sections. So the New York Times has human moderators that review every comment, but Perspective helps them to sort them and help predict whether a comment is likely to be perceived as toxic.
Tool? Is that trained from toxic conversation?
Yeah, exactly. The way that you teach a machine how to spot toxicity is you show it a lot of comments. And you teach it to understand what toxicity is. And after reading millions and millions and millions of public comments, it learns really well. And it ends up being able to be even more precise and consistent in detecting toxicity than human raters are.
How interesting. It's a lot faster, of course.
Yeah, it's a lot faster. It never gets tired. It never gets
PTSD,
annoyed and traumatized from having to read a bunch of toxic comments.
Yeah,
it's pretty handy.
Do you charge companies like the Times to use that?
No.
So this is a free tool that they can use.
It's a free tool.
That's really
it's open sourced. Almost all of our work, if it can be open sourced, we open source it.
Yeah.
And that's really important to us because part of what we want to do and part of our mission with Perspective is really to inspire the developer community to use these tools to build new and interesting applications and find new ways to make this kind of technology useful. And we're expanding it to more languages.
Wow, that's just awesome. Obviously, with 60 people, there's a limit to the number of things you can invest your time in. So there must be some sort of process to say, okay, we're going to do this, but not do that.
Yeah, there's a little order to the madness. First of all, we tend to focus on a specific set of issues. So using technology to make the world safer is obviously a pretty broad remit. And we choose to focus on certain specific issue areas within that space, both for the sake of focus and really to make sure that we're looking at problems where technology is really at the core of the issue.
Ah, interesting. Yeah.
There are lots of other organizations that are well-equipped to deal with problems like world hunger, for example. But at the core of that problem are really politics and logistics, whereas many of the issues that we focus on are really sort of at their heart technological issues. So there are a number of criteria that we sort of apply when we consider new projects. But you're absolutely right that we have scarce resources, and so we have to be selective of how we apply it. But all of that said, our work with partners and our engagement with other communities is part of the way that we kind of scale that impact. Yeah. So going back to working with developers, building a tool is one thing, but if you can inspire developers to build a bunch of different applications that all draw on the same technology, or if you can help to inform tech development from a bunch of other places, we consider that time well spent too.
Well, and so the partnerships can be, I mean, the list of things that you've done that I have used and frankly, that most of our listeners have used and just don't know it is extensive. Share the facts. So this is an example of something that you did with Duke and then has now been graduated. What does graduated mean? It's no longer under your auspices?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we're a relatively smaller team. And, you know, most of the time when we work on an issue, we're not necessarily, you know, we may have been the best organization to build something and to bring it to the public, but we're not necessarily in the business of running a bunch of products that have hundreds of engineers supporting them and that exist under our auspices forever. And very often there are other organizations that are better equipped to scale our tools to new audiences or to help, you know, continue the development on them. So graduation is sort of our term for when a project goes to some other organization. In many cases, they go to Google or another one of our sister companies within Alphabet. But it means essentially that we're in a more supportive role and less in active development.
Right. In your offices, you have a kind of hall of fame or a wall of fame of people who were extremists who converted, kind of were shift. Why are those portraits up there? And I'm looking at a picture that was in, yeah. I think, Business Insider when they toured your offices. Black and white portraits of former extremists who abandoned violence in order to work for peace. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. So we've been studying violent extremism and the role that technology plays in sort of recruitment pretty much since the beginning of Google Ideas. And the portraits that you mentioned, they're really stunning black and white portrait photography by Mark Seliger of former violent extremists who attended our very first summit, the Summit Against Violent Extremism. And you're right, these are all people from many different countries, many different ideologies, many different backgrounds, who all were radicalized, who joined violent extremist groups, but then renounced violence, left those groups, and dedicated their work to getting young people out of these groups and to preventing them from recruiting more. So we keep their portraits around to remind us, you know, of the impact of our work. I think it's, you know, they're serious pictures and they have sort of grave expressions, but I think they all sort of represent the hope that that, you know, people can change and that with a little effort you can really make a difference in preventing violence.
We're talking with Dan Kieserling. He is the chief operating officer of a Google sponsored think tank called Jigsaw that's doing some really interesting work. A small team out of New York City that's doing a very interesting kind of set of tools, I guess, I don't know if you would express it this way, but to kind of make whole some of the problems that technology has brought us.
We'll take that.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of awesome that Google's doing this, because as much as I think a lot of us were very optimistic about the internet in the earliest days and said, this is going to be democratizing, it's going to eliminate friction, it's going to make governments transparent. We had all the highest hopes, and none of us really thought about some of the negatives that would come about. I'm actually really impressed that 10 years ago Google was already thinking about this and actively doing something about it.
I think the more that technology starts to change and affect so many different parts of our lives, I think companies like Google and Alphabet realized a long time ago that they're going to have to confront these issues whether they like them or not. And I think I can't, you know, speak for Google, but I think their motivation in creating our team is really to have a team that's apart from core business and apart from philanthropy that really looks at the future and the role that technology is going to play in all of these threats, not just so that we can understand them, but so we can do something about them. And, you know, Google has always been a company that operates under a certain set of values.
Yeah.
And we're really transparent about what those values are. And they absolutely stand for, you know, expanding access to information, freedom of expression. So I think we're an embodiment of that. And it's as much a pragmatic concern as of understanding these threats as it is about, you know, putting our money where our mouth is.
A number of people, I don't include myself in this group, but a number of people, including some Democratic candidates for president in 2020, think that Google is part of the problem. In particular, I think people are looking at YouTube and its recommendation engine, how it seems to give rise to extremism. How are you addressing that?
Well, I can't speak for Google or YouTube.
I understand. I'm not, it's not your fault.
But,
but
no.
But are you addressing? Are you thinking about it?
We are absolutely looking at the issue of radicalization online, and it's changed a lot since we first started to look into the issue. When we first started to explore the role that technology plays in radicalization, just to like provide sort of context, Al-Qaeda, which was at the time the most prominent Islamic extremist group, when they wanted to disseminate a message, they would record something on a VHS cassette, courier it to an Al Jazeera affiliate, and several days later it would appear on TV somewhere. A couple of years ago when we started to explore the role that technology played in ISIS recruiting, the game had totally changed. And so our approach to this issue had to evolve with that. So we've invested time in understanding how groups like ISIS recruit, how they disseminate propaganda. And specifically, we've conducted an experiment to see if we can reach people who are vulnerable to that kind of radicalizing message and provide them with information that that undermines that mythology. So specifically, we ran a targeted advertising campaign to reach people who are at risk of joining violent extremist groups. And we provided them with links to YouTube channels that curated content that undermined ISIS mythology. And the results from that experiment were really encouraging. And we've published all of that, open sourced it, so to speak. And now that same methodology is being used to target people who are vulnerable to joining all kinds of different violent extremist groups.
How's it working?
You know, I don't click on ads very much. And hopefully that's not too controversial for me to say. So I was really surprised. Hopefully the connection doesn't just go dead after I say that. But I was really surprised by how successful this pilot was. So we ran an 8-week pilot where we ran ads. We didn't do anything to search results. This is just a simple ad campaign. But it wasn't that simple. It was sophisticated in that it specifically tried to reach people who were at a stage of the radicalization process where they had an affinity for extremist content but hadn't taken the leap completely, so to speak.
Right.
We were surprised by how many people clicked on these ads and were compelled by the messages that they contained. And then once they clicked on the ads, and they were taken to these YouTube videos, you know, the sort of obvious thing is, well, oh, as soon as they realize it's not what they were looking for necessarily, they would click away. But they didn't. They watched this content and they clicked through these ads at significantly higher percentages than comparable search results. So for us, that kind of data shows that we can reach people who are at a certain stage of that process, and we can show them content that they watch. So learning from those experiences has helped other organizations design similar targeted advertising campaigns to address extremism across a number of different ideologies.
Jigsaw has kind of four, I'm looking at your website, jigsaw.google.com, kind of four, you call them challenges. Does everything you do come down to these four challenges: to end repressive censorship, to fight the rise of online mobs, disrupt online radicalization and propaganda, and to enable transparency and accountability? Those are the four. Is that a litmus that you apply that to anything that you're thinking about doing?
Yeah, that's pretty inclusive. There may be one or two things we're working on now that may not easily fit into one of those, but for the most part, I think those encapsulate sort of some of the big existential challenges of technology and security around the world.
Right.
How do we have open conversations? How do we ensure access to information? And how do we protect people from threats?
Right.
I think those are still a pretty fair representation of our work.
Although the overall mission is how technology can make people safer. So that's obviously morphs as time goes by, as we discover new threats. These days we talk a lot about assaults on free press. We talk about fake news. We talk about online harassment. You deal in things like password security. I actually use one of your plugins, the Safer Password plugin.
You're getting in all the plugs. We appreciate this.
so it's also online security. Password Alert is a Chrome extension that lets you know if you're. Is it just the Google password, or is it all passwords are compromised?
I think it's just your Google
just
password.
Just the Google password, yeah.
Yeah.
But this is intended not for necessarily average people, but for journalists and people who would be the target, like Martin Podesta, of an attack on their Google account.
Well, it's available for anybody, and we'd encourage everyone to download it early and often. It's free. The reason why we focus on those kinds of let's call them like bread and butter security issues, is because for all the sophisticated cyber attacks out there, and there are plenty, most security threats, the vast majority of security threats and the ways that networks get compromised are through pretty basic techniques.
Yep.
Phishing, for example.
Spear phishing.
You know, fraudulent emails, spear phishing, malware, the sort of usual stuff. It's not the sexiest threat. It's not super complicated, but it's devastatingly effective. And so if we want to be serious about, for example, protecting political organizations from cyber attack, we have to, be willing to take care of those basic needs first. And if you don't take care of those basic needs, it doesn't matter how complex your security is.
We talk a lot about, and I hadn't really put two and two together, but a lot about your projects when they emerge into the open world. I'm thinking of Outline, which we talked a lot about, which is a VPN for anybody, but initially for journalists, right, to protect their security from surveillance from big governments, things like that.
So a lot of our work, a lot of our work focuses on supporting journalists, because in some ways this may sound weird, but we kind of think we're a little bit in the same business in terms of making information available and useful to people. And journalists are almost always on the front lines of these issues. They operate in dangerous places. They operate in places that are hostile to press, and they're the ones who tell us what's going on. And keep us informed and keep, open societies functional. So we care a lot about journalism in general, and a lot of our technology addresses a lot of concerns that are common to that industry, both because it's important to us, but also it's because that's where the threats are. So Outline, which you mentioned, it's cool because, so VPNs, hundreds of millions of people use VPNs all over the world, virtual private networks. And they help to circumvent government firewalls, give you access to the open internet and also make your internet traffic less safer from surveillance, make it safer from surveillance. And the thing is, though, it's often hard to know whether you can trust a VPN. There are hundreds of VPN providers all over the world. And so a lot of people like to create their own VPN, but that's really, really hard, or it was until now. And so Outline makes it dead simple for any organization anywhere in the world to create your own VPN and share it with as many people as you want. So specifically for organizations that are operating in countries with repressive governments, places that do not have strong freedom of the press or access to information, a tool like Outline can be vital for making sure that you can get access to the free and open web and that you can share that access with your network.
Do you ever get heat from repressive regimes? I won't name any particular country, but either aimed at you or aimed at your parent, saying, hey, knock it off.
Yeah, we get calls once in a while.
Has been very principled, to use it as an example, in China, has been very principled and said, I was so impressed that, Larry Page said, fine, well, we can't do business in China anymore because they want information that we're not going to give them. And I thought that was incredibly impressive. But I'm sure that there's little small things you do all the time that make other repressive regimes angry.
So I think I'm sure that's certainly true. I think that many of the governments who are considering how to approach technology from a national security point of view understand that this is a little bit of a cat and mouse game.
They don't want to really come out loud and say, hey, you're not letting us shut down our free press. Get out of the way.
I think one of the difficulties that that governments who are trying to restrict access to information is that people want access to information.
Right.
And so, the sort of fundamental needs and desires of people to know what's going on, to be able to exchange ideas, to express themselves, is fundamentally at tension with governments that are trying to curtail that.
You bet.
And
there are more and more of them all the time.
And we're not the only organization that provides these kinds of tools. We try to contribute to the ecosystem. We try to make the best tools that we can, but we're certainly not alone in this challenge. And so we're really grateful to be part of a broader community that works on these issues.
No, and except some of our friends have spent time training journalists, training dissidents to be secure. Dan Patterson's gone out into the world and helped train people. I really enjoyed Maciej Czyglewski's blog post about trying to teach democratic campaigns fundamental security and how challenging that was.
We've been out on those road shows too.
He says, just buy the blue YubiKey. Just buy that. Buy 20 of them, please. Just please. You have a great what do you call jigsaw projects? Pieces? Puzzle pieces? Is there a cute name for them?
We go back and forth about this, and I'm going to get in trouble for choosing favorites. I think we call them projects.
Projects is a good name. You have a great project, digitalattackmap.com.
Yeah.
A lot of our geeks love maps. We all love maps.
And say that with love.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is I had actually not heard about this until I started reading more about what you were up to at Jigsaw. Digitalattackmap.com, Anthony. It's really a cool real-time map of online DDoS attacks.
Yeah, so I was talking about Project Shield earlier, and we built Digital Attack Map long before anybody in public ever used the word DDoS. And we did this to sort of highlight how global the problem was and also to provide more information for people who were writing about or scrutinizing this kind of thing to really understand the scope of the problem. So what you're looking at here on the screen
are these are a bunch ongoing. Oh, this is December 6th. This is a This is a going back in time in history.
Yeah, this is a classic. Yeah. And
one of the greats.
Cool,
who can forget?
Exactly. I know. Yeah, I have to be careful not to geek out on this and realize that these are
bad news for people. Yeah,
very bad. Yeah. But the cool thing about this map is that it does let you go back and look at really big DDoS attacks in history and. It sort of gives you, you know, a visual frame of reference to understand sort of what it looks like. You know, for people who are listening, there's a map of the world with a bunch of colored arcs that represent ongoing denial of service attacks all over the world. So it sort of provides a global view of this is a really busy one.
It's depressing when you look at it. There's just it's horrific what's going on. This is in March of what year is this? 2019.
This year.
Yeah.
Wow. So one of the canonical examples that you can look at on Digital Attack Map is when it was at the time the largest DDoS attack in history. It was directed at a website called Krebs on Security.
Yeah, Brian by Krebs. Brian Krebs.
Whom many of your listeners may know. Brian put his website on Project Shield after his... He was under such considerable DDoS attack that his provider at the time, for which he was paying, said that they couldn't support him anymore. It was becoming too expensive and burdensome. So they gave him a warning, and he went around looking for a new free service, and he joined Shield. But the reason why I bring that up is because I would direct all of your listeners to read his essay, The Democratization of Censorship, which he wrote shortly after that experience. But I think it's one of the most fluent articulations of how these kinds of attacks have ushered in sort of a new age of quiet censorship.
Well, and whether it's a nation state or just an individual hacker, they're so easy to perpetrate. And I mean, you can there's even DDoS as a service now.
Sure. It's for $5 or something. I mean, if it wasn't illegal, I could show you here on my laptop.
I know
how to do it. It's troublingly simple and straightforward.
And requires no technical skill either. That's what's really depressing.
No.
Actually, that's an interesting question. I don't know if you know the answer, but are nation states more of a threat or are individual attackers more of a threat?
I think it depends. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not sure how to answer that question because I think it depends on what kind of threat you mean and the circumstances. I think... For the average person, I think random individuals and criminal organizations are more of a threat than nation states are.
Right.
But it is true to say that governments all around the world are investing in the capability. Oh, the lights in my office went out. This is motion
suspicious. No, wave your hands.
There we go.
Great.
Yeah, exactly.
It's an energy
right
saving.
The nation states doing cyber attacks.
We heard that the grid was at vulnerable, so maybe.
Yeah, I have to be careful not to say a couple of trigger words. I think nation states all around the world are investing in the capabilities to wage cyber war. And they're doing that because it's effective, because it's asymmetric. Governments without strong militaries and without a ton of money can invest in hacking or disinformation operations and wield power beyond their borders. So we're paying really close attention to both of those fronts, the sort of everyday sort of criminal activity and also the sort of growing space of interstate cyber conflict.
I worry quite a bit because the United States has announced it's going to be, develop increasing offensive capabilities for cyber warfare, and we know that we have adversaries doing the same back. I really worry about it going from a cold war to a hot war, and what would that mean for everybody? Do you sometimes go home discouraged, or is the work you're doing making you feel better about all this? Because I get discouraged.
You know, it's going to sound super cliche, but working here makes me hopeful.
Yeah.
Partly because you see that technology can have a positive effect. You know, day in, day out, you can even meet with individuals whose lives have been changed or helped because of tech tools that didn't exist yesterday and exist today.
Right.
So that's really cool. And to be surrounded too by just invention, by the constant activity of coming up with new solutions to, in some cases, really old intractable problems. You know, once you get used to the idea that things that seemed impossible can suddenly become possible, and that, you know, the nerds sitting right down the row from you can build something that can change someone's life. I don't know. I think it's kind of hard to be cynical.
Yeah.
I mean, that's which isn't to say that the problem isn't daunting.
Yeah.
But I think, like, you know, for those of us who work in this space and who sort of, you know, come to work every day trying to use technology to make people safer, our experiences leave us undaunted.
Yeah, I think probably what's discouraging to most of us is the helplessness we feel, and you're actually doing something about it. So it's despite the fact that you probably know more about how bad it is than anybody.
Well,
at least you have some tools. You're doing something about it.
The other thing that I think is a real source of kind of inspiration and motivation for us at Jigsaw is a big part of how we work is going into the field. I mentioned this before. And that's really important because it makes us make better technology. And I think we understand, you know, the realities of the world better. But it's also important because we meet people, human beings, individuals firsthand who are confronting these issues in a really extreme way in some cases. And we get to know them. You know, they're our friends. And whether it's a journalist in Venezuela or, you know, an activist in Angola or people working anywhere in the world, you know, we call these people to better understand how people are really using technology and how our tools work, how we can improve them. So, I mean, building those individual relationships, it makes these kind of big abstract problems personal.
Yeah. I imagine there's some competition internally to say, I want my project. I got this idea. How do you get people aligned behind the projects you're doing?
Brute force. No, I was kidding. You know, I mean, this is one of the cool things about like Google and Alphabet culture is it's a very like bottom up environment. So the way that projects often gather support is organically. Yeah, you know, people say, oh, this is cool. This is promising. I had never thought about this approach before. Right. Let's do it. I know something you don't know that can help make this product more successful. And the one of the coolest things about working here is there really is, and this is not just a platitude, there really is a sense of like trying to be helpful. When you see something that doesn't work right, people will kind of come around you and try to make it work. And that spirit of collaboration, you know, you end up kind of building little movements on the team and say like, this is really important. We should do something about it. And I think we've got a viable solution here.
Yeah. Do engineers rotate in from Google or how does this work? Do you hire people directly into Jigsaw or?
Yeah. So we hire people directly into Jigsaw. A lot of those people, I would say the majority, I think that's right, come from Google. We recruit from Google.
Oh, you steal people from Google.
We borrow from our sister company.
So can somebody get a 6 month or a year assignment to Jigsaw to?
No, they're not time bound, but it's not uncommon for people to kind of bounce around teams.
Okay.
That's true in the tech industry in general, but it's also true at Google. People will come over here because they want to work on a specific project. And then maybe they go somewhere else, or people will come over here because they have a specific skill set, or they just really love the mission and they'll stay and work on a bunch of different projects depending on their interests. But there's a fluidity within the company and among Alphabet companies that's really cool and that allows organizations to kind of evolve as their needs change.
Yeah, it's really exciting. To see this work being done, and there's little things and big things. You I saw on your Twitter feed published a how to know if you're being phished quiz.
Yeah.
That people can do.
Yeah, everyone should take it.
Yeah,
I got questions wrong, and I helped to make it.
So there you go.
Well, I mean, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that like some of the most important security concerns are the most basic. And, you know, phishing is basically the most common form of cyber attack in the world.
Yeah.
And the consequences can be pretty bad. Now, if you're using Gmail, which all of your users should be, of course, Gmail does a really great job of filtering out the vast majority, 99.whatever% of any malicious spam.
Yeah.
But not every email service is quite as good at that. And so we built that to help people learn to spot the signs of phishing.
Nice. What else? Tell me about some other projects. We've covered most of the current stuff that you're up to. Is there anything we've missed?
What do you want to talk about? Like election security?
Election security. Is there an election coming up? Oh, that would be interesting.
There's always an election somewhere.
That's true. Yeah, that's important. It's not just in the U.S. It's all around the world. But are you working on U.S. election security?
Yeah, sure. We're working on election security everywhere. So a lot of our tools are directly relevant to the context of elections, because elections are sort of just they're an intense period of increased news coverage, increased political activity, increased civic participation. And so they're also, unfortunately, they're sort of, you see an increase in the frequency and severity of cyber attacks around elections. Because just as I was saying that, you know, governments and political organizations are investing in these kinds of capabilities, they're using them as tools, as political tools also. So all around the world, we take our tools and we host trainings. We try to get our tools into the right hands of political organizations and activists around the world to just help sure that campaigns and individual candidates, political organizations are all as protected as possible. So that effort's called Protect Your Election.
Mm-hmm.
You can use your favorite search engine to find it online and download all of our very free tools.
Nice. And you find uptake is pretty good in the U.S.?
Yeah. So we've spoken to, you know, all the parties and candidates from a bunch of different states, made these tools available. We also have – Google has a program called Advanced Protection. That
yes.
just adds a couple more layers of security to your Google account. And we try to get those into the hands of prominent figures who are sort of more at risk of being attacked. I think, you know, for one thing, our efforts are proving successful at evangelizing this kind of stuff, but also people care a lot more than they used to. I think, like, and we owe that to a couple of sort of famous examples of hacking.
John Podesta, but I think people was the big, that was the one that woke everybody up, I think.
People are savvier.
Yeah.
And I think they understand how important these issues are. And so now, when we started, we really had to sort of pound on doors and persuade people. And now we're being greeted with open arms.
I don't know if this was Google or just the general press, but when Advanced Protection came out, I think it was people pointed at the John Podesta DNC hack as being, this is why we created this. This is exactly why you need to use a authentication token.
Yeah, phishing happens to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Mr. Podesta just had one of the more famous examples.
Unfortunate. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Dan. Dan Kieserling is the COO of Jigsaw, which you could find at jigsaw.google.com. You can also follow them on Twitter if you want to keep up on their activities, twitter.com/jigsaw. There's a lot of stuff you're doing. And what I love is it's in many languages. It's definitely a global effort, and I think that's fantastic too. And are you ever looking for interns, Dan?
Are you offering to be our intern?
I want to come over. I want to hang out. I'll bring you coffee, anything you need.
Yeah, come on. We got a desk for you.
Is it centralized through Google, or is there a separate Jigsaw internship program, I wonder?
We have software engineering interns.
Nice.
We have every summer.
Nice.
Among other, but there are lots of ways to get involved.
Is that part of the Summer of Code thing, or?
I think it's separate from that.
Separate. Nice.
Yeah.
Because I'm just thinking there's probably young people watching right now who, unlike me, are not cynical and jaded. They're ready to take on some of the bigger challenges in the world, and I think that this sounds like a good place to go.
Well, apply for a job.
There you go.
Come visit us.
Dan, a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for the work you're doing. Yeah, I think this is it's nice to see. I hope Google gives you 10 times the number of engineers and 5 times the money.
I'll write that down.
Yeah, would you? I'll talk to Larry. Because honestly, this is an important thing to do, and it's more than a public relations effort. It's something that I think every big tech company needs to participate in this kind of activity to make the differences. Thank you.
Thank you again.
Appreciate it. Dan Kiezerling, COO of Jigsaw. We do Triangulation Friday, every Friday around 11:30. Well, for me anyway, I guess it's all different times, isn't it, Anthony? For me, it's always Friday at 11:30 Pacific. That's 2:30 Eastern, 1730 UTC, 1830 UTC if you want to watch live at twit.tv/live. Join us in the chat room. You're the third side of the triangle. Our chat room is always useful. Go to irc.twit.tv if you're watching live. And, of course, on-demand versions of everything we do, including this show, are available at our website, twit.tv/TRI. Check in regularly because there's always something interesting happening on Triangulation. Thanks. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.